Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, it's not at the finish line yet, but the bill allowing a referendum on Charlotte's transit plan has a huge win in the North Carolina House. More revelations about additional money paid to CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings, this time for moving expenses when he was hired. The NAACP's national convention will be in Charlotte next month, but Donald Trump is not invited. It's the first time the organization has excluded a sitting president in its 116-year history. Charlotte Skyline gets a new sign, the 14-foot red and yellow Wells Fargo logo, and Ardrey Kell High School gets a new principal. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE climate reporter Zach Turner. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV, Channel 9. And Ben Thompson is midday and morning anchor at WCNC-TV. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
So for months, legislative leaders said there was only a 50-50 chance that the General Assembly would green light the bill granting Mecklenburg County permission to put a transit sales tax referendum on our November ballot. This week, however, the House voted 102-6 in favor. Mecklenburg County's Tricia Cotham was the bill's primary sponsor.
This is a tremendous victory for Mecklenburg County today, one that has been talked about, planned, dreamt, and today it moves in its first time from the House over to the Senate with tremendous bipartisan support.
So, Joe, is this her doing?
I think that she deserves a lot of credit for this. Yes, that 102-6 vote is impressive considering we weren't sure if this would ever get a vote. From what I've heard, she's been whipping and working on lawmakers behind the scenes. And now that will go over to Senator Vicky Sawyer in the Senate to see if she can get a majority of her colleagues to support this as well.
It should be noted that Vicky Sawyer is also from Mecklenburg County, so they both have connections to the area that's asking for permission here. This passed on its second reading with another yet to come, and of course it has to go, as we said, to the Senate and then to the governor before we can have final approval. But this is being described as a huge win. I said that at the beginning, but those are not my words. When a bill has that kind of support, Ben, is it more likely to pass through both houses?
Absolutely. I mean, clearly there is more support than a lot of folks anticipated for this. I mean, we talked about this sort of incarnation of this bill for a few years, but the bigger issue for far beyond that. So this is honestly by far the most momentum this has ever had by a long shot. So the numbers there in the House were decisive. It wasn't even close. If it's anything like that in the Senate, this is really encouraging news for all those folks who've been working to get some sort of transit and that 1 cent sales tax on the referendum this November.
And Alex, this momentum that Ben just referenced seems to be really sudden. Now, we're a couple of hundred miles away from Raleigh, but it just seems like it languished in the legislature and in committees and just being talked about as being, maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. And all of a sudden, bam, it's happening. How? Why?
Yeah, I think going back to Joe's point, I think Representative Cotham deserves a lot of credit for getting this moving. It just seems like it came up very randomly in the Transportation Committee. It just moved super fast and has a ton of support behind it. And I think that a lot of the lawmakers really understand that this, at the end of the day, is a vote for Mecklenburg County voters. It's not really, if we don't want it, we'll vote no. So I think they recognize that, and they also see this as a blueprint for their counties as well. If they want to implement a transportation tax, that's something that Cotham brought up, and I think that that's a good point for others to consider.
This bill, Joe, has gone through several permutations, but as it passed through the House, as that bill is currently comprised. Mm-hmm. It would earmark 40% of the sales tax money collected for roads, 40% for rail, and 20% for buses and on-demand micro transit. It does not address the town of Matthews' desire for light rail, and Matthews is part of Tricia Cotham's district? Was it just too much of a heavy lift for her to make that happen?
The bill only specifies one project in particular that has to be built first, and that's the red line to Lake Norman. And then the rest will be deferred to this transit authority that is created, and they will ultimately decide what lines will be built. The fear from Matthews is that as it's composed with 40% of the funding going to rail, 40 to roads, 20 to buses, there just won't be enough money to extend the rail past Bojangles Coliseum in East Charlotte.
And I know that Ben wants to chime in on this, but Alex, you reported earlier this week that town leaders in Matthews are still looking to derail this bill and the transit tax referendum. What are they doing to make that happen?
Yeah, we've spoken before on the show about how some of the town leaders in Matthews are not as opposed as they once were to this plan because they recognize that they're going to get millions of dollars for road projects, so they're not completely left out. But the commissioner, Ken McCool, did show up to the finance hearing this week, and he was hoping to speak in opposition to this plan and to say that the city and its partners have spent over $40 million designing the Silver Line, and that this plan is just going to throw that all away and waste all those tax dollars. And he also announced this week that he was going to run against Tricia Cotham. Obviously, his problems with the transit plan are a motivating factor for that. So.
He is Mr. McCool. Ken McCool is a three-term Democratic commissioner on the town commission in Matthews. And as you said, he told Channel 9 that he would be challenging Tricia Cotham for her seat in the next election.
My goals is to be the voice of this district. This district does not feel that they have a voice up there.
So Cotham beat her Democratic challenger the last time around, even after she switched parties from Democrat to Republican and gave the legislature their Republican supermajority, really angered a lot of people, yet she still won a very close race. Is McCool right about what voters feel, Joe, or are those just words of a political challenger?
I think there are Democratic voters who certainly feel that way. But, you know, I think 2026 is a long time from now, too. We really have to see what the atmosphere is like, you know, as we get closer to the election then, to see like how elected officials are being perceived, which party. If, you know, sometimes in the midterm year, the party in power, voters kind of rebel against them. So that could work against Tricia Cotham. At the same time, she has shown a very strong ability to get money for her district. And that could be a motivating factor for voters as well, because she secured so much money for her district, in Mint Hill and Matthews in particular. And she could have an argument against Mr. McCool saying, hey, I'm in the party in power. If you guys want resources for our district, vote for me.
There is this throw the bums out kind of sentiment in the United States for people who have been in office and the party in office is suddenly out of favor. But given the realities of gerrymandering, is that really possible anymore, Joe?
Her district, it is, because it is a very, she only won by 213 votes last election. So her district will be a toss-up in 2026, unless they remake the map. So who knows?
There's also a Senate version of this transportation bill, SB 584, which, like the House bill, would establish a 27-member board of trustees to lead this new public transportation authority in Mecklenburg. Ben, does the Senate version hold any hope for a Silver Line train to Matthews?
No, not really. It seems like that there's going to be, you've got these competing factions here, and Cotham said about this legislation this week, if everybody's completely happy, it's not good legislation. A bit glib, admittedly, but but her point is that there's a lot of competing factions here. And you've got the folks in North Mech who said, we were promised this 20 years ago, we better get it. And they're adamant, as are their lawmakers. You've got GOP lawmakers in Raleigh who have said now, going back at least 3 years, it's got to be 40, 40, 20. 40 for transit, 40 for roads, 20 for bus. They've said that all along. And you have city council that had their big plan that has somewhat fallen apart. You're not going to get all those people happy all at the same time and the people of Matthews. It's just there's not enough money given the parameters that GOP lawmakers have put on the plan. It's not going to happen.
As you say, this 40-40-20 thing was put back into the plan by Mecklenburg County because legislative leaders, they kind of demanded it. Joe?
At this point, Charlotte and Mecklenburg County supporters of this need to hope that the Senate version doesn't move forward, because the Senate bill has a provision that says this referendum can't be held until the budget passes. And we got Destin Hall and Phil Berger both saying now that they don't think a budget will pass anytime soon. Right. So if the Senate version were to move forward, then, you know, they could be doomed into not being able to have this referendum this year. And going back to the buses, because Tricia Cotham's bill originally was a 40-60 split. And from what I understand, there was some behind-the-scenes lobbying to get that 20% for buses spelled out, because buses are the backbone of the CATS transportation plan. And so many people depend on that service and will need it in the future. And it's almost a privileged standpoint to say, like, who cares about buses? This is a very important part of the plan, and CATS really wants that 20% to ensure that they can improve it for the people who rely on that service.
I want to come back to that comment that Ben referenced a minute ago from Tricia Cotham when she was talking about people who are upset with this bill. She said, if everybody is completely happy, it's not good legislation. Really? Really?
This seems like one of those, like,
I guess in this day and age,
given there's limited resources, given there's limited resources in any project, yes, no one's ever always going to be happy in compromise.
I just don't like that statement. I don't think that statement really means anything.
Okay, well, we're going to move on, because usually it's the other way around. If you're displeasing people on both sides, then you're doing something right. But clearly, the inverse does not work for her. One of the big stories of the summer so far has been the agreement reached behind closed doors between Charlotte City Council and Police Chief Johnny Jennings to head off a possible lawsuit filed by the chief over text messages sent to him by former City Council member Tariq Bakari. The payout amounts to about $305,000, $9,000 a year in pension for the rest of his life. But this week, WCNC-TV Ben reported on even more money being paid to the chief at the beginning of his tenure, more than $77,000. For what?
That's right. Our Nate Morvita broke this story wide open, and it was $77,000 for moving expenses. Just from the outset, that's a ton of money. That's more than a lot of people make, you know, every single year. It's even a little bit more head scratching when you think about the chief then was an employee at CMPD and was living in Union County. Well, city statute says this chief needs to live inside city limits. Okay, so you move. But I mean, you're talking about less than 30 miles. You're talking about moving one county over and a charge of $77,000 for the moving expenses.
Did he ask for that amount? Was that just given to him? What was that? What did that pay for? Because a moving van from Union County to Mecklenburg is not going to cost you $77,000 unless you live in a 14,000 square foot home. So what's the deal?
The city says that this is standard practice. When we reached out to the city, Nate did, they said it's standard practice for Charlotte and for other cities to pay up to, for certain positions, not for an average city employee, but for certain positions, up to $60,000. Now, beyond that requires Charlotte City Council approval. Well, as of this morning, it's not clear to us whether Charlotte City Council approves this, because I know you spoke to Malcolm Graham earlier this week, and he learned about it from our reporting. So at this point, it's not clear what happened, because they should have voted on this, and it's not clear they did.
We will hear from Malcolm Graham about this. This just sounds a little profligate to me, and a lot of the things that have been going on at city government with money, at least, sounds like they're just throwing it around. But maybe I'm wrong, but we'll find out when we come back. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Alexandria Sands, a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Joe Bruno's a reporter for WSOC-TV. Zach Turner will chime in on climate and other recyclable things a little bit later on. He's with WFAE News. And Ben Thompson is the morning and midday anchor for WCNC-TV. And we were talking before the break about the $77,000 moving expense payment that was paid to CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings at the beginning of his tenure, because although he was an employee of the police prior to his becoming chief, it is a rule that the chief must live in the district. So he moved from Union County to Mecklenburg County. And I'm just curious if anybody has detailed how that money was spent. Was the $77,000 for the moving van? Was it to pay the difference in the cost of living? In other words, if you sell a house in Union County and you have to buy one in Mecklenburg, it's going to be more expensive. Was it for that? Was it for other things? What was it for?
I've not seen, and I don't think Nate's been able to get his hands on an itemization of how exactly that money breaks down. But yeah, it was specifically for the moving of a house into another county.
I thought part of it was split between, didn't they have it like two buckets, like the selling of the house and then the actual like relocation fees?
Yep.
Okay.
And this, he's been chief of police for what, 5 years now, I think. And this information came from newly obtained public records. Why is it just coming to light now?
Well, I think there's an intense scrutiny on not only the police chief right now, but the money the city has agreed to pay him through a number of venues. We spoke to the folks over at the Taxpayer Protection Alliance, a nonpartisan group, and when we interviewed them, they said, yeah, there seems to be a consistent pattern here in the city of Charlotte of paying really large amounts of money to the police chief over the course of his career, and specifically over the last 5 years. Yeah. That should concern any taxpayer.
And to others, not just the police chief, but the exiting city attorney was paid, and they just paid extra to the interim attorney to have him stay to the end of the year. Malcolm Graham, city councilman, was on this program on Wednesday to talk about his new book, but I had to address this with him, this $77,000 payment to the chief in moving expenses. And as you alluded to, Ben, a moment ago, he found out about it from you.
That was the first I heard of that yesterday.
How can it be? You're on city council.
The police chief reports to the city manager, and that's an HR issue.
So is there a problem in city management? Because this is not the first incidence of something like this. There's a lot of money being thrown around.
I think we have a governance structure problem, and I think that we have to a culture that we have to change the culture internally from a management perspective. I think our mayor needs to facilitate our meetings better. I think we need to look at how we process our work in terms of every major policy decision should go through a council committee. It does not.
How should we regard those comments, Joe?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm hearing those comments for the first time. There's a sense of frustration in general with how things are going right now, but for different reasons. And Councilman Malcolm Graham very clearly has expressed a desire for things to change, like better run meetings, keeping council in the loop on bigger projects, council having more of a say. His other explanation about the payment itself, I can actually see council not being in the loop on this because it is the city manager negotiating with and probably the city attorney negotiating with the police chief, and HR is involved. And then you can argue like city council should be briefed on something as important as the police chief, especially when there are questions about whether they should have had to authorize $77,000 in relocation payments. And you know, the city's explanation is, well, it was $52,000, and then with tax it gets to $77,000. That just doesn't pass the smell test.
Yeah,
so there's a lot of things going on with this,
and with all the fees that we're talking about that have been paid in the last couple of months, and the ongoing $9,000 a year in we're eclipsing $500,000 here.
Yeah, because regardless of whether city council should have had a say, city council is going to be blamed. And I don't think a voter is going to accept the excuse, well, like this was on the city manager, because they still expect a certain amount of oversight from their elected officials, even if the governance structure is set up this way.
He was on the program on Wednesday, Joe, and I just want to point out that since that was the first time you heard those comments, this program airs every morning at 9.
Oh, okay.
In May, Jamie Brooks, the former principal of Ardrey Kell High School, was suspended with pay and later announced her retirement. This week, CMS named Dr. Susan Nichols as the new principal.
I realize that change can be challenging, but it also brings new opportunities. I want to assure you that my commitment is to build strong bonds and earn your trust.
Ben, is she the one who has to build trust, or is it CMS?
I think she acknowledges the fact that it's going to be incumbent upon her to do a lot of the heavy lifting here. Not to say that the district doesn't have to do the same, but based on what she said there on the district's YouTube page after the announcement, that she acknowledged she's going to have to put in the work to build that trust. And I know you have a clip of some of the parents we spoke to, but they also explained to us that this was not about her, that they weren't upset about her. And of course, they want her to succeed. It's in their best interest that she succeeds, but that they still didn't feel right about how the district had handled this.
Yeah, Kelly Ludwig is one of those parents of a student at Ardrey Kell who spoke with your TV station about the appointment of a new principal. She's among the many parents frustrated by the lack of transparency in the process. But the lack of transparency is about the process and also now about the previous principal disappearing with no real explanation.
We asked the question over and over in that principal profile meeting, do you already have someone? Do you know who you want to put in here? And we were told no, time and time again. We were actually told that the new principal would be put in before July 1st, and we were very concerned. That was an awfully aggressive timeline. And here it is, June 18th, and they've already named the new principal? Come on. Really hard to believe that they didn't already know who they wanted to be put in there.
This new principal is being shifted over from a magnet school. Is it a magnet school or is it a charter school?
It's a charter school, Charlotte okay. Engineering Early College.
Okay. Could the lack of answers about their potential decision be because they were still in discussions and you don't want to reveal that and put her employment in jeopardy until they pull the trigger on hiring her? Is that could be why they drag their feet in explaining this?
100%. Of course. I just think to these parents, it still looks like it was sketchy. And when Kelly, the parent that you just played, when she talked to them, administration officials, and they said, hey, we hope to get it by July 1st. And here they are 2 weeks before that with somebody. It makes parents who are already skeptical about the way this whole thing has been handled, it makes them think, now, wait a second. Did you already have this person picked out before Jamie Brooks was ever even let go?
Yeah, because it was the backing up. It took 3 weeks for CMS to inform parents of the suspension of the previous principal. And many of those parents expressed concern over that lack of transparency. Carla Stovall, who is an Ardrey Kell Parent Teacher Association president, told the Charlotte Observer, quote, I want to know why we didn't know sooner. What you're saying to us is there is an issue, but you're not telling us what it is or how to fix it. Has CMS ever responded to that?
As far as I know, based on our reporting, no. It's been a personnel issue, and it's left parents with a feeling that you hear in some of those sound bites, frustrated and annoyed. And it also puts Susan Nichols, 27-year veteran of the education profession, it puts her in a tough spot, starting off with all this extra baggage that comes along with it, none of it to her fault.
We have experienced a series of departures over the years at CMS, at the superintendent level and elsewhere, also at the city, for which there are no answers as to why these people leave suddenly and without explanation. And many times they cannot comment, they say, because of laws or regulations surrounding personnel issues. Joe, you talk about transparency and the lack of transparency a lot. Is that a legitimate excuse? Taxpayers are paying these people's salaries, and when you're talking about CMS, these people are in charge of our children. And if they've done something wrong that affect our children, shouldn't we know?
I think parents deserve to know. I think CMS is very conservative of how they interpret the law and what they can say. it will be interesting to see if the state ever takes a look at this to better, you know, because the state right now is very big into parent rights and knowing them having more knowledge about what goes on inside the school walls. It will be interesting to see if they ever take a look at providing parents with more information when there is a sudden departure like this.
Switching gears around the nation, ICE has taken to arresting people at courthouses and workplaces and other locations where they suspect undocumented immigrants will be. Often the people making the arrests are in plain clothes. They're often wearing masks. They have no identification markings. They don't often display an arrest warrant of any kind. ICE is allegedly looking for people who are here illegally, but who have also committed crimes. Alex, is that who they are rounding up?
Well, I spoke to two immigration lawyers here who believe that they're going more after the low-hanging fruit, especially at the courthouse. These are people who are showing up for their immigration hearings. They're having the cases dismissed, and then when they walk out of the hearing, they're being arrested and put on a fast track for deportation. So they're kind of showing up to have their case heard, and then that's disrupted. So it's not exactly going after hard criminals here.
Yeah, we are hearing those incidents of people trying to comply with the law by checking in with the courts at their appointed time, only to be arrested when they walk into the lobby or walk out of the courtroom and back into the lobby. That's happening around the country. How often is it happening here?
I'm not sure how often it's happening in the courthouse, but I'm told that the ICE agents are there every day, morning and night, wearing their regular everyday clothes, their t-shirts, their baseball hats, and just waiting for people to come out of their hearings.
Clearly, this is not going to stop. Mass deportation is exactly what Donald Trump promised during the campaign, though the tactics weren't explicitly spelled out. Most recently, his administration's been going after Democratic lawmakers who have been trying to ask questions of ICE or of Homeland Security officials who have been checking on the status. And they've been checking on the status of people who have been already arrested and taken into custody in their states or districts. And one Democratic member of Congress has now been indicted on federal charges that she assaulted a law enforcement officer during a protest. The video shows otherwise. Yesterday, the Department of Homeland Security issued new guidance requiring members of Congress to give 72 hours notice before visiting ICE detention centers and completely barring access to ICE field offices, which are often used to hold migrants at least temporarily. Democrats say this violates federal law, and it would appear to cancel out the oversight responsibilities of Congress, a co-equal branch of government. Can we remind people that the Constitution spells it out that way? Do we know what congressional response has been to this, either nationwide or among our representatives in North Carolina, Alex?
I'm unsure. Is anyone else on the panel aware?
I mean, I do know just from following our own Julian Berger's tweets that we have these two important immigration bills that are largely anti-immigrant, I think, that are kind of sitting on the governor's desk right now. And that's
what is Ted Budd and Tom Tillis and our congressional representatives saying about particularly the Democrats who are being locked out of this process, apparently? What are they saying? Is there any pushback at all? Okay. Meanwhile, more than a dozen Latino elected officials from the state have sent Governor Josh Stein a letter urging him to vote to veto those two immigration enforcement bills that you referred to a minute ago, Alex. One of them passed with one Democrat in the House crossing the aisle to say yes to it. Has Josh Stein, the governor, commented on either of these bills?
He hasn't commented, and he's coming up on his deadline to do so. I believe it's tonight, midnight.
It's tonight.
Mm-hmm. He's apparently in Paris, or he was in Paris. Yesterday, his office announced that he was going there for the Paris Air Show. So I'm not sure if that impacts his ability to possibly sign these bills by the deadline. All we've heard from his office is just a statement where he says that, you know, being in a being here, if you're here illegally, you should be deported.
To be clear, he has until midnight tonight to either sign these laws, veto these laws, or they become law on their own. Affordable housing here, as we all know, is in short supply and may soon be diminished even more. Joe, a developer, has plans to construct apartments and retail spaces near Prosperity Church Road, where a mobile home park is now located. The owner wants to sell the land, and the potential buyers want the area rezoned to accommodate their plans. How many people's homes are we talking about that are at risk because of this?
I believe it's a couple dozen homes with multiple people living in them. So a little more than 100 to 200 people at risk of losing their housing here.
WFAE spoke with Yolanda Valentin. She's a 20-year resident of that mobile home park. We translated her comments.
We have invested a lot in that place. We have invested around $80,000 to $90,000. All of our savings have been spent on our walls, our floors, our yards.
Not being able to get back the money she invested is a concern for her, but Leo Chavez, who has lived at Forest Park Mobile Homes for 15 years, says he doesn't know where he could move and pay anything resembling what he's paying for rent there now.
Nowhere I think in Charlotte, are we going to find a place with $500 rent? So, yeah, it'll be pretty devastating, not only for us, but to everybody who lives there.
Most members of City Council spoke out against displacing residents at Monday's meeting. The residents there hope that council will reject the rezoning petition so they can collectively buy the property from the owner. When will we know, Joe, the council's decision on this?
The council will decide at the earliest August, but this is a tough one because the owner has sold the land and the owner has already told residents that regardless of what happens with the rezoning petition, they need to be out by the end of May of 2026. These homeowners own their properties, like their actual mobile homes, but they don't have ultimate control of the land. I don't know. Even if council rejects this, I'm not sure that the homeowners have much recourse if this owner is dead set on selling it to a developer.
And I don't know how much land is available for mobile homes, but are these the type of housing that can be moved?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how that whole process works. Okay. I do know the developer says that they are going to work on a transition plan for the residents. I don't know what that looks like either, but I would assume that'd be part of it.
When we come back, the NAACP has not invited Donald Trump to their national convention here in Charlotte next month. We'll talk about a lawmaker who has gotten herself into some trouble because of a protest sign or a posting about that sign and more. Stay with us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks. Zach Turner's with us, our climate reporter at WFAE News. Alexandria Sands, a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Ben Thompson, midday and morning anchor for WCNC-TV. And Joe Bruno, who is a reporter for WSOC-TV and an occasional anchor himself. Donald Trump has become the first sitting president in the 116-year history of the NAACP to not be invited to their national convention, which will be held next month here in Charlotte. Why did they decide not to extend an invitation, Joe?
The theme around this year's convention is fighting for the rights of democracy. And the head of the NAACP said that inviting Donald Trump would go against their theme and wouldn't advance their mission. It's important to note that he was invited throughout his entire presidency, as well as last year when he was running, and he did not attend.
Derek Johnson is the NAACP president you're talking about. He says this has nothing to do with politics. It's about civil rights, and he says Trump has made clear that it is his mission to eliminate civil rights. Has the White House responded to this snub?
The White House has not responded. In one of the times he was invited during his first term, he said he wanted to address the convention, but the organizers changed the format of it. And so that's why he didn't attend. But that's the most we've ever gotten on that topic.
And we should point out that this the allegation that it's his mission to eliminate civil rights is semi evidenced by the fact the NAACP has filed multiple lawsuits against this administration, among them a suit against the Department of Education for withholding federal money for schools that did not end DEI programs. So last weekend, millions of Americans participated in this No Kings protest, many of them in this state. I think 5 million Americans across the country did this. One of those protesters carried a sign in Raleigh saying, "In these difficult times, some cuts may be necessary." It pictured a guillotine and two life-sized heads, one of which resembled Donald Trump. And a picture of that was posted on Facebook by Democratic Representative Julie Von Hafen of Wake County. Some Republicans called for her resignation. Ben, I know the answer to this, but why?
They claim that this goes way too far. And of course, this happens within the prism of lawmakers up in Minnesota who were assassinated this same weekend that this all happened. It's a sensitive topic, but no party can really claim a moral high ground on this at this point. I mean, I think everybody agrees, including the representative, that this was a bad idea to post this. She took it down. She spoke on the House floor. She apologized. She said nobody condones political violence. And I think everybody agrees that we have got to lower the temperature right now in the country. But Republicans, I mean, they don't have a clean record on this. They ran a superintendent candidate, Michelle Morrow, who tweeted about the assassination of President Biden and President Obama. They ran a lieutenant governor candidate and then governor candidate, Mark Robinson, who said some people need to be killed on the campaign trail. Voters are going to have to decide, is that sort of language, whether it comes from Democrats or Republicans, is it acceptable? And if it is, if it happens, then how far does an apology go? Is that acceptable or is it not acceptable? Or does we do not need apologies for those things.
State Democratic Party leader Anderson Clayton chided Republicans by pointing out similar rhetoric, as you just said, from their own candidates. And, of course, Donald Trump cannot claim innocence in this either because he started this trend of saying things that used to be beyond the pale and would have been disqualifying for any candidate who said them. Hafen, although she's been asked to resign by Republicans, is not resigning, but she did, as you say, apologize on the floor of the House, admitting that the image she posted was inappropriate.
I apologize to members of the House, to my constituents, and to any North Carolinian who is offended by what I posted. I'm sorry. Every one of us needs to take accountability for when we make mistakes. I am taking that accountability today, and I appreciate the opportunity to do so. Thank you.
So this is very much like the incident that nearly ended Kathy Griffin's career as a comedian, very much like it, as a matter of fact. And I'm just curious as to if there's a double standard going on here, because it seems like Republicans can say anything, and Democrats don't necessarily demand a retraction. But if the reverse is true, they want their heads, no pun intended.
Yeah, Kathy Griffin appeared on a magazine cover back probably 5 or 6 years ago with a mock-up of the president's head, decapitated, same sort of thing. And she's been very open about the fact that her career has never been the same since. She's tried a number of comebacks and had a few, but her career has never been the same since that happened. And to your point, is there a double standard? Some say, yes, there is. And Democrats, are they held to a different account than Republicans are necessarily? I mean, again, Republicans that can say that they're offended by this and it's wrong, and I think most people will agree, but Republicans ran these candidates 6-7 months ago. So I mean, right, if you're outraged by one side, you got to be outraged by the other side.
Well, let's talk about recycling.
You can pivot.
Thank you. I'm the king of pivots. Zach Turner is with us, our WFAE's climate reporter. And Mecklenburg County's recycling program is about to get a boost. How so?
Yeah, so this week they just opened up a new recycling center on Pence Drive. This is going to be replacing, for a time, the Ample Road facility. that they have, and it's going to be doing functionally the same thing. It's going to be taking in about 350 tons of recycling or materials that they're going to try and recycle. And while they're doing upgrades to the original facility with the goal of adding in these new automated sorters, being able to process things quicker. And then eventually they're going to transition this new facility into processing more commercial materials.
Yeah, here's what Mecklenburg Solid Waste Director Jeff Smithberger had to say about this.
As our community grows, we got a lot of wood products, plywood and brick and block and things like that. Those things will come here to this facility to be able to be recycled.
In your story about this on our website, Zach, you point out that a lot of people believe that recycling is a hoax. Is it? What happens to all that stuff in those green bins?
That's a good question. Well, in Mecklenburg County, at least, a lot of it's staying pretty local. All the stuff that we do, we put in our like bins, we put on the street, that curbside recycling, what they call single stream recycling, that all goes, that's treated here in the county at these recycling centers, in this case, the new Pence Road facility. The rest, we have these various full service and self-service centers around the county that you can go to where you can recycle things like, I don't know, foam, you can do batteries. And a lot of this stuff ends up staying within the region. It's not something that we necessarily recycle in Mecklenburg County, but it'll go to partners that we have in South Carolina, Georgia, which is great because that's also insulated us a lot in terms of these tariffs and kept our recycling costs down.
Mecklenburg County Commissioner Elaine Powell is the chair of the county's Environmental Stewardship Committee. She was at the opening of this new facility, and she emphasized the importance of this new facility to our waste needs.
We will never build another landfill in Mecklenburg County. There's no land, you know, we don't have enough land left.
So has recycling had an impact on that? Because I know years ago we were talking about running out of landfill space and finding ways to reuse those landfills. And really the only way out of this is recycling. Is that proving to be beneficial?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it has been. I think that's kind of the main selling point. They have found a way of making this be like a financially sort of stable model of recycling. But I think one of the main benefits to the county is just the space that they're saving in terms of landfill space. That's sort of their main incentive there is just to free it up. So they, like what Powell said, you don't have to build more landfills.
So I'm not a meteorologist, but I used to play one on television. We've had what appears to be a relatively cool, wet early summer, but so far, but it's about to get hot. And last month, Charlotte officials pointed to the rising number of extreme hot days as the number one climate risk in Charlotte, which is a problem for some renters in our area. Zach, why?
Yeah, so in North Carolina, we don't have a mandate for landlords to provide AC. We have it for heating. It's part of this 1997 Residential Rentals Agreement Act that said that landlords basically had to provide habitable, safe conditions and said that they needed to sort of remediate any sort of dangerous conditions. And they specifically listed cold. You can't have things getting too cold in these apartments, but they didn't say anything about heat. And so in Charlotte, we don't have an exact figure, but there's an estimated several thousand units that don't have any AC. That's going to become a problem as conditions become hotter this summer and more humid.
And heat stroke is a real problem, and much of the heat is generated in the most urban of urban areas, and that's a place where a lot of people do not have air conditioning. For years, advocates in the local area have urged the city to institute an air conditioning mandate, but city council says their hands are tied. Council member Dimple Lejmera.
There's nothing we can adopt in terms of the ordinance at the local level because we are bound by the state law.
So what, if any, options do people have as we approach these hottest days of the year?
Yeah, and I guess to push back on that, like, it's not necessarily that, like, the city, I don't know, has necessarily tried to put a mandate that, you know, we have AC in these units. There is this, like, argument that North Carolina is a Dillon state, which some also disagree, Dillon's rule state, which some disagree on, meaning that the local government can't, like, pass laws that aren't explicitly allowed via the state. But in this case, like, with that 1997 Residential Rentals Agreement Act, like, it does seem implicitly that they could put forth some kind of AC mandate here. But right so now, for, oh, go ahead.
Yes, I was going to say so far no mandate, but they are partnering with NCDHHS, North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, to provide fans to at-risk residents. Do fans, are they an adequate, when it's 100 degrees or more outside and you're in a house that's probably a lot hotter because of that, do fans do the job? Do they get the job done?
That's a great question, Mike. And if anyone was listening to NPR just before this show, we had somebody come on that was talking about the fact that once it gets too humid, our bodies aren't able to evaporate that sweat that we're creating in order to cool ourselves down as part of homeostasis. And so when it gets hot, you have these fans that are supposed to sort of help with that process of sweat evaporating. But when it gets too humid, like what we might see during this upcoming heat dome that's going to start on Saturday, it's going to become increasingly difficult for people to find that relief. And box fans really aren't going to help. They're just going to circulate that hot and humid air around an apartment. So folks are going to have to look for places like cooling centers in order to find that relief.
There was a bill going through the General Assembly that Dimple Najmera said she was looking at carefully. It's sponsored by State Representative Tracy Clark, who says AC ought to be a necessity, not an amenity. It is a human right. But that bill looks dead for this session. One by one, the 14-foot-tall letters that make up the Wells Fargo logo were hoisted and installed on two sides of their tower at 550 South Tryon. For years, our skyline had no signs across the tops of these buildings. Now they're everywhere. I'm just curious, Alex, what changed?
Well, I think for Wells Fargo, this is they view this as a branding opportunity, and it's a really good way to make sure nobody calls this building the Duke Energy Center anymore. I'm not sure if there was an actual thing that shifted that made this a trend in the Charlotte skyline, but Wells Fargo certainly now holds the record for the biggest sign.
Ben?
Yeah, 2021, February, Truist put their big old billboard on top of what I would argue is the coolest building in Charlotte, one of the cooler skyscrapers, I would say, in the country, and that's the Hearst Building. So I am just a news anchor, but I would say on behalf of all the designers and architects out there, you know, these companies spend a ton of money designing these buildings and drawing up these buildings, and then they lop a billboard on the side of it. If you look across the street from the Wells Fargo Building, the brand new Duke Energy Center, it has Duke Energy on the top, but it's part of the design. It looks like it goes with the entire building. It's not this retroactive billboard being put on a side of a building. Sorry, I feel strongly about this.
Well, the Wells Fargo sign's on the handlebar building, for those of you who are wondering what we're talking about. It's the building that has a big handlebar across the top of it. But you know, Ally Bank has a sign on their building. Regions Bank has a sign on theirs, as does Bank of America in their South Tryon area location. The new Wells Fargo logo is, I'm told, the same size in terms of letter height as the Truist sign, but Truist has fewer letters. You know, there are signs atop buildings all over this country. No one says boo about it. This is a news story. Why?
I think people are just very possessive of the skyline. It is very big. When I saw it, like actually after it was installed, having covered this, I just thought, oh my God, I knew it was going to be big, but I didn't know it was going to be that big. It's very eye-catching. And it actually makes makes Bank of America Tower look smaller, I think. So I don't know if that's some competition between the banks there, but it definitely draws your eye away.
Of course it is. Where do you live? Of course it is. We have a story, Zach, you have a story about an unusual pairing going on between the North Carolina governor, the Democrat, Josh Stein, and the Republican governor of South Carolina, Henry McMaster. What are they cooperating on?
Yeah, they're trying to prevent any expansion of oil drilling into the Carolinas. They're saying that this is not something that is needed and would be detrimental to our rather robust tourist economy in the area.
Hmm. And this is something that I think that the Trump administration wants to encourage. Drill, baby, drill was a motto during
that's,
the
That's what
cycle.
They're saying. That's what they're saying. They got a lot of unused gas leases right now in other parts of the country. Not really sure what expanding that area would do for them. And not sure that that's necessarily going to increase the demand for oil and gas, but they sure do want to try.
Meanwhile, the Charlotte Checkers lost last night. They're in the Calder Cup Finals, but they're falling behind the Abbotsford Canucks. You're the hockey person here today, Alex. This is a best of seven series. Do they have to win the next game or they're out?
The Checkers have to win. They have to win because I want to go to another hockey game before the season ends. And to do that, we need game six.
That's because it's cold in ice rinks. That's why you want to go. And it's summertime. All right. Alex Sands, Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. Ben Thompson, midday and morning anchor for WCNC-TV. Joe Bruno, reporter for WSOC-TV. And our very own Zach Turner, climate reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.